Chris O'Mara and Joshua Lehman.
This is an SDIC interview with Chris O'Mara of Lehman Brothers. It is Friday, July 16th at 10 a.m. from the FCIC. You have Troy Burris, Bruce McWilliams, Joby Dan Gannon, and Sarah Knauf.
Meeting with us today, doing this phone interview, really appreciate that. We've got some general questions for you. We don't have any kind of materials that, you know, obviously we're going to be asking general questions, and hopefully you'll, you know, be able to answer those questions and kind of give us some more information for our purposes to help us with our report. I'd like to first start off with you just giving us a little bit of your background, you know, your education, where you started after you got your education, how long you were with Lehman, some of the different positions you held there. That would kind of help us out.
Sure. Let me go back to my days at Georgetown. So I graduated in 83 from Georgetown with a degree in business administration, with a concentration in accounting, and went to work at Arthur Young, which was one of the predecessor firms to Ernst & Young, right out of school. And did that for about 9 years, and then went to work at Bankers Trust. I was a finance person in their custody division, where they served as custodian for clients of securities. Did that for a year, and then left and went to Lehman Brothers in 1994, right at the time of Lehman Brothers going out public, out from under American Express. And I joined Lehman. My first role at Lehman was with regard to balance sheet and capital management reporting and analysis. Did that for a little bit, and then added the functions of the allocation of interest, cost of carry across the firm, and became the assistant controller, and also added the daily revenue reporting flash, if you will, to my responsibilities. So I did that up through, let's say, 1996, and in 1997 I became the CFO for the investment banking division, which is at Lehman. It was just the division that handled interaction with banking clients. So it was the division that did M&A advisory and capital raising for clients. Did that for 3 years, and then in 2000 I became the financial controller for the firm, which essentially kept those responsibilities for the investment banking CFO and added the responsibilities of the items I previously had around balance sheet and capital management reporting and analysis, the daily flash of revenues. It also added external reporting, legal entity controllership, accounting policy, budgeting, and business planning, and expense management. And then about a year or so later, I took on the responsibility of being the full controller for the firm, not just the financial controller. And in the full controller firm, I also took on the responsibilities of product controller for the fixed income and equities units, which previously had been separate from the financial controller function. So that was the controllership function. I did that until December of 2004, when I became the CFO, and I was in the CFO seat through November of 2007. And in the CFO seat, I was responsible for, in addition to financial control and product control, I was also responsible for tax and treasury and investor relations, expense management, and basically Europe and Asia as well. Had a mirror finance functions in Europe and Asia as we did in the U.S. So that was the responsibility up through December of 2007, when I was tapped to be the global head of risk management, and did that right up until the bankruptcy. So December 07 through September 08.
Had risk management reported to you in any of your earlier capacities?
No.
Okay, and you said that that last position were you the CRO, or is that a different position?
Well, it's it may be a distinction without meaning. I was the global head of risk management. For whatever reason, folks didn't want to call it the chief risk officer. I don't know if that was something that sort of was viewed maybe differently by Dick Foles, who was involved in the risk agenda, maybe viewed himself as the chief risk officer, although I never really got into the distinction, but it was my title was global head of risk management.
Okay. All right. Great. And then at the bankruptcy, you were no longer with the firm, or did you stay with the holding company afterwards?
I joined Barclays for a transition when there wasn't really a role. I wound up being hired back by the holding company to help unwind the holding company, and in particular the derivatives at the holding company. So I'm working and I'm doing that now, working with Alvarez & Marsal as the restructuring firm that is essentially in charge of the liquidation, and I am a manager of what we call the asset streams. Now, there's a series of different product categories that are being unwound, derivatives being one, and I'm co-head of the derivatives unwind.
So when did you leave Barclays?
I'm not sure. Might have been October or November of 08.
And then you work for the estate.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, great. Let me ask you a question about when you took over as CFO in, you said December of 2004, you became the CFO for the firm. Who did you replace in that role? Who was your predecessor?
Dave Goldfarb was the CFO, and yes, I replaced Dave because Dave got a broader position as the CAO, Chief Administrative Officer, and I reported to Dave. When I was CFO, I reported to him as CAO.
Okay, and then was Aaron Callan the person that replaced you as CFO?
Yes.
Okay. When you were CFO, you said you reported directly to Dave Goldfarb. Is that correct?
I did. In the early days as CFO, I did. And then in the later days, Dave wound up shifting roles from CAO to a different role, and I then reported to Ian Lowett.
And what was Ian Lowett's position at that time when you were reporting to him?
He had become CAO, but he was co-CAO. He was one of two CAOs. So he was CAO, but co-CAO.
Okay, and who reported? Who were your direct reports? Who, when you were CFO, who reported to you?
I mean, it's sort of, I don't have any sheet in front of me, so I'm just going to try to remember back and just tell you for the different functions.
Sure.
Tax was John DeRosa. Treasury was Paolo Tannucci. Product control was Jerry Riley. Financial control was Ed Grieve. Investor relations was Sean Butler. Europe was Richard Amat. And Asia was Enrico Corsellini. I think I had some other people around it. I had a trying to think. There were a couple other direct reports. Oh, I had somebody who did oversaw the corporate areas, like technology and things like that, who was the finance professional overseeing those areas. That was John Ambrose.
Okay.
But yeah, those are the key ones I went through.
Okay.
And the CRO did not report to you, is that right?
Correct.
Who did the CRO report to?
The CRO reported to Dave Goldfarb, at least up until some point, and I don't know what point it didn't report to Dave anymore.
So when you transitioned from CFO to this global head of risk management in December of 2007, who did you replace in that role?
Madeline Antonczyk.
Okay. And then who did you report to when you were head of risk management? Who did you directly report to?
So I reported to three people. I reported to Dick Fold, Joe Gregory, and Ian Lowett.
Okay.
Did you have direct access to the board?
I did make presentations to the board and felt perfectly comfortable having, direct dialogue with the board. My correspondence or communication with the board was through either the committee. There was a risk committee of the board that met periodically, and so I had access to the board formally in those committee meetings, and also to the full board through a couple of updates that I gave to the full board as the risk officer.
When you presented to the board, did you have a sense they understood what you were talking about?
Yes.
They asked good questions?
Yes. You know, I think they were involved. These were folks, for the most part, that had been on the Lehman board for a while and had gotten grounded in, certainly the key matters, and had gotten grounded in being, broad business people with financial acumen over time.
I wanted to ask you, when you were CFO, we understand that there was a meeting in Florida in 2006. I think it was in Turnberry or someplace along those lines. Did you attend that meeting or that conference?
I did.
Okay. During that meeting, was there discussions around risk levels and changing risk parameters or risk tolerances? Do you remember anything along those lines?
I remember it being about the sort of growth of the firm and the plan of building out and growing out the firm. I remember more about being a discussion on growth than particularly around risk, but risk would have been a component of it somehow, that growth would have touched on the increase in risk necessary to support that growth.
And what was the sense that the firm needed to they were looking at growth targets or increasing the growth or increasing the way they were doing business? I mean, what was this sense of the meeting that the firm was too conservative, needed to be more aggressive? What was the sense?
Oh, God. I would say that the thought was, you know, Lehman had developed its brand, was a firm that folks, you know, that could now attract talent, and the thought was that, you know, this is an opportunity for us to leverage the firm and the brand of the firm to basically take it to the next level, to grow out various businesses that we wanted to be in. And it was, you know, sort of an offsite for senior managers to talk about how we were going to do that. And so there was some presenters who had some topics to, you know, talk about how we were going to grow out the firm.
Can you name the specific businesses that you plan to grow?
I think it was all, you know, I think it was all the businesses that that we were in. I don't think it was necessarily about, you know, getting into brand new businesses, although I could be wrong. It was more about, you know, let's sort of target to you know, really build out the various businesses that we were in, including the investment banking business, where you know, we were going to try to do more things and become more relevant as a provider of financial services to our banking, to our big banking clients. I don't remember the meeting specifically, but I do remember it being about growth. I'd have to come back to you with more specifics on it. I just don't remember all the specifics.
Was there a concept of growing by serving clients in terms of trading and so on, or was it in terms of growing the balance sheet?
I think it was both. I think it was sort of, let's build out these businesses. You know, at its heart, Lehman was a sort of a client flow intermediation business, matching, you know, havers of capital with needers of capital. But there was a an understanding that Lehman could take some amount of principal risk, and had the business system that would put it in touch with opportunities to invest alongside of our clients in ways in which we would see opportunities that could be sort of interesting investment opportunities for capital appreciation. So there was some of that that was that came into play. I don't know if it was right there in 2006, but you know, at some point, that was you know, a business that we got sort of more into, but it wasn't, you know, it didn't become the dominant business in the firm. But yes, I think in growing even the client businesses, growing those client businesses out required you know, a broader business system, which would require more positions essentially to be in the warehouse. And so there was a you know, sort of a plan that called for a growth of the balance sheet and risk, as well as growth of you know, revenues and net income.
And what about leverage?
I don't know about the growth of leverage at that time, but you know, certainly it was going to be the growth of balance sheet, and that growth would be supported by growth in equity. So I don't know about increasing leverage at that time.
Okay.
How about commercial real estate?
I don't know if that was part of the discussion at that time that that we're talking about, but you know, there was a view that Lehman's connection into the commercial real estate business as a leading player in it was something that could be further further leveraged or further developed to continue you know, the build out of that business and profit making on it.
What are some of, I mean, you were a CFO for a pretty good time frame, almost, well, what, 3 years or more than?
Here.
Yeah. What were some of the issues or the big issues that came up, something, anything that stands out in your mind when you were CFO that you were having to deal with as far as has the Lehman Brothers overall business? Were there any big issues that stand out in your mind that were problems that you had to deal with?
No, I think the big challenges, as I think back to the time, was just about the growth in all of its different forms that we were trying to build out businesses in different countries. We're all challenges that somewhere along the line we acquired Neuberger Berman's business to build out our asset management business. We were building out the mortgage origination businesses. We were building in India. There was discussions about getting into Russia, which we ultimately did. We were trying to build the business all over the world. And one of the challenges as CFO is to try to help figure out how to allocate resources to all these various competing growth priorities that were coming from all the different regions. Asia was a big build out area for us as well, and it was just a big growing firm that had had a mandate to continue to develop its various businesses.
You might not have looked at this as CFO, but you would have looked back at it as a global head of risk management, and that's the question of operations risk. To what extent did you feel, as global head of risk management, that Lehman had adequate technology infrastructure to support that kind of rapid growth?
Yeah, it certainly was a challenging point, and a good one. We had an operational risk function, and was something that I sort of bolstered when I came into the risk seat with a sort of a very experienced professional. But it was something that was a challenge. I think we did have adequate infrastructure, but it was not without challenge.
When you were head of risk management, I keep wanting to call you CRO, did the infrastructure...
I think that may not be a meaningful thing.
Okay. Did you have a picture firm-wide of the firm's risk position in various dimensions? Did the infrastructure give you that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we had that.
So let me ask you this. When you became the global head of the risk management, what kind of issues came up there? Were there concerns that you had about the risk levels that Lehman was taking? Did you raise concerns with your people you were reporting to, either Mr. Fold, Gregory, or Lowett, about maybe exceeding these risk tolerances or risk limits that were set?
There was always lots of dialogue around risk. Risk discussions were not limited to formal meetings. There were lots of discussions around risk, both in aggregate and in particular categories. But once I became the risk leader, we had reset the risk tolerance levels at the beginning of the year, and at some point in early 2008, there was a decision to sort of reduce the risk taking and the asset positions in the firm, particularly for less liquid assets. And so generally, risk was sort of coming down during my time as the risk manager. So we didn't get into a situation where we were on the aggregate bumping up against those risk levels. There were a couple of divisions and a couple of businesses within divisions that were, but in aggregate we weren't, and the mandate was clear from the center that, the idea was to dial down risk in 2008. And that's what happened.
Sorry. I'm hearing a subtext to what you're saying, and I need to understand it, which is once the board and company management has stated a risk appetite, that it's a job of the risk officer to implement that risk appetite. Is that accurate?
No, it's maybe nuanced, but it's really The businesses themselves and the traders inside the businesses, they're the ones who take the risk, and they're the ones who have to, you know, sort of dial it down. The risk officer is about sort of helping to set the parameters and then sort of monitoring and measuring the risk that is at play, and then, you know, sort of raising the flag around situations in which there are, you know, risk is bumping up against limits, which need to have a solution. But it's really the sort of the specific decisions about what risk to dial down, and, you know, how to dial it down and how to manage out those risks. That's really made by the business folks, the, you know, the sort of frontline trading leaders.
Let me ask the other side of this, if I may. The job of the risk officer is to raise a flag when risk is bumping up against limits. Does a risk officer have any role with respect to saying, gee, those limits are too high?
Yep. I think that that is something that the risk officer certainly has a say in that. And that's really, you know, sort of goes to the risk committee and to the executive committee of the firm, but certainly the risk officer has a voice in that.
The risk committee of the board or of management?
Oh, no. The risk committee of management. I'm sorry. But there is a risk committee of the board, but that's a separate. That's not what I was talking about.
Okay. And you, during this period, you were comfortable with the limits that management had set?
Yeah. You know, yes, but it was, you know, as you know, through your guys' travels, I'm sure you've come across, you know, it was really a, and hindsight, you know, gives you a good perspective on it. But at the time, there was a lot of volatility. There was a lot of these, you know, toward the end of 07, there was, you know, a lot of positions that certainly the less liquid ones, leveraged loans, that were stuck. At some point, there was a, you know, this huge pipeline of items that had been funded, but the market was not digesting them. And so the thought was, let's sort of let them work their way out in sort of a, well, rather than fire sale them out, let them work their way out in sort of a more normal way, which is kind of the way we did it around the leverage loans, and they, you know, generally did get digested in the market. You know, toward the end of 07 and early 08, and so, you know, there was an idea that said, hey, let's let these things go out in a normal course, let's keep some pressure on them, make sure they're moving out, but it certainly wasn't alarmist in terms of, you know, the way that I was seeing it at that time.
Did you feel you had, you were in charge of a pretty strong risk function, a bunch of people that knew what they were doing, and systems that gave you what you needed?
I did. I think the risk professionals that were in the seats of the, you know, the leading seats around the risk function were terrific. You know, Madeline Antoncic, who had the position before me, had hired just a great group of people, and I felt very comfortable.
And how many roughly were in the risk function?
In total, there were about, I don't know, 250 or so people directly, not including the technology group that was supporting risk. So maybe there was maybe 250 or so without the technology people, and, you know, probably another, you know, 200 or so in the technology. You know, technology for risk was a big deal. But the risk management department itself was, I think, about 250.
Great. Okay. I've got more questions. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
I want to ask a question on risk management that probably relates back to your CFO position, if I might. How did Lehman protect itself against liquidity risk? What kind of limits? How did you approach liquidity risk?
Well, we had a couple of different models of for liquidity protection that we had at play. And, you know, the underpinning of it was that we needed to fund all positions that couldn't be reliably funded in a secured funding market would have to be funded with equity or long-term debt that had a maturity of greater than a year. And so you had to set aside essentially a cash cushion to be able to pay for a series of things that could happen in a stress environment over the course of a year, including things like if you got into a stress environment, there would be haircut widening on secured funding. There was a whole series of potential cash outflows that could happen in a stress environment, so you had to guard against all of those to cover you for a year, including, you know, debt that was rolling due within that year. But the underpinning was that you had to fund with long-term debt anything that wasn't reliably fundable in the secured funding markets.
Lehman grew substantially, and the examiner's report takes it from fourth quarter 06 to second quarter 08. Or first quarter 08, and it's 48%. Do you have a sense that that liquidity protection grew commensurate with the size of the firm?
I think it did. There were some challenges around liquidity toward the end, certainly, looking back on it. But I think the liquidity model was set up to be to support the firm through a stress environment for a long period of time. And, there wound up being some challenges, some unforeseen challenges that took place in 08. But.
Okay, I need to ask a question. A fast-growing firm, at least if you talk to the bank examiners, and you guys are governed by bank examiners, but a fast-growing firm immediately raises flags about, what's going on with risk? But if I hear you talking, you're relatively comfortable, if I heard you right, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that, in fact, risk management was keeping up with the growth and size of the firm. Is that a fair statement?
I would say yes, but maybe with some caveats. But yes, I think is the overall answer. I think, it was not without challenge. And, one of the things that is pointed out is around moving from, the way that you sort of look after risk for highly liquid, tradable assets to things that are less liquid. And but certainly the risk function was continuously developing. And, there are different ways of looking at risk that, many of the leading minds in the risk area were, continuously looking at different angles of thinking around risk. And, the function was just continuously developing. So I don't want to leave you with the impression that, the Lehman risk function had all the keys to the kingdom. But it, certainly had terrific risk professionals that were constantly thinking about the various kinds of risk and things that could happen, things that could go wrong, and developing out the sort of the risk infrastructure of to support the firm.
Do you have a sense where your predecessor went?
My predecessor, Madeline?
Yeah.
Meaning while she was at the firm, what she moved into, or
no? As you essentially stepped into a CRO type position. I assume she had that before you, or at least a large piece of it.
Right.
Do you have a sense where she went?
Yeah, she took on a role of, financial market policy relations for the firm, which I understood was something that she wanted to do and essentially crafted her own role, was, basically to be a person in the firm who would get engaged with, sort of all of the policy making and global financial policy market things that were happening in the world, to plug Lehman into that, because Lehman, you know, prior to that, really only had one or two people who would actually play in that world, which was Dick Fold and Tom Russo, and Madeline was a person who, you know, could be leading that agenda for the firm.
So your sense, and the Examiner report has some pretty strong words of praise for the risk function. Your sense is that top management supported the risk function, or were there exceptions to that?
When you say supported the risk function, can you be more specific about that?
Let me say that I talked to somebody who had a senior risk position at a different firm who said a risk officer must always be ready to walk the plank. That basically a risk officer can't really implement important risk protections unless the top management is backing them up, because you're basically telling people, you know, limit this transaction, don't do that transaction, don't deal with that counterparty, and that means, at least in some people's eyes, a loss of revenue. So a risk officer has a difficult role that at least traditionally would seem to require top management support.
Yeah, I would say that that the firm senior management supported the risk function. I don't think it was sort of this blind support. I think the at Lehman, and I assume at many of the firms, that the executive committee members, the leaders of the firm, actually got involved in the individual risk decisions, the major risk decisions, that they got involved in making those decisions as a committee themselves, together with the risk function, in a way that built consensus around, you know, the decision, as opposed to, you know, sort of just deferring the decision to the risk officer solely. The key risk decisions were actually made by the executive committee of Lehman.
Can you talk a little? Archstone closed, I guess, in October of 2007. You came in just after that. Is that as a chief risk officer? Did you have any role in trying to look at Archstone from a risk perspective?
Well, I was part of it at the time. I was CFO. I would be involved in some way in looking at the large items. So yes.
Can you talk a little, just sort of take us through the Archstone transaction from the way it was initially conceived to the way it played out?
And well, I think, yeah, even though it closed in October, I think the deal was actually inked in earlier, before the mid-year point. I don't know if it was May or April or something like that, where the deal was agreed to. And then it, you know, took its time to, you know, go through the things necessary to close it. And then it wound up closing in October. The, you know, the theory on the Archstone deal was that it was going to be, you know, disseminated out into the market over time. At the time that it was committed to initially, you know, there was a, you know, you might remember back at that time there was a you know, very, very significant amount of investing capital that was available, that was looking for investment opportunities. The business folks who led the Archstone deal from our commercial real estate business felt very comfortable that this was a deal that its component pieces would be distributed into the market, you know, but over time. And you know, they had had some good conversations with folks who would be the, at least some of the people who would buy into this deal. And so at the time of in October, there, you know, it wasn't so crystal clear. They still felt comfortable that it was a deal that could be distributed. May take some time to get it out into the market. You know, the market had run into some turbulence. But the view, there was certainly a good process held by the executive committee to sort of reevaluate that deal at that time. and a decision was made to continue to stay on the path and go forward with the deal. A lot of things that the business people sort of touted about the reason why it continued to be a good deal, even though the market was a little more challenging. Among those things was that, that Archstone had properties, performing properties in the best locations in the best cities, and that the cost of replacing the Archstone properties was actually greater than the price that was being paid for it, if I understood that right. So, the view was through a process that, had a healthy debate, that we should move forward and do that transaction. And that was the decision made by the executive committee.
Now, there's a sentence here, and I can't find it as I'm flipping through the report, that says basically in Archstone the views of risk managers were not particularly considered. Did you have a sense of that, that basically this had been lifted to a higher level in the firm for decision?
I think it was lifted to a higher level, but I don't subscribe to this this concept that somebody's views aren't considered. I think views are considered. I just don't think that everybody always has the same view. I think the exec committee made the decision for Archstone.
Okay. I have only two other questions. One is a general question that we maybe can drill down into. There's been a lot of talk about the fact that the way people in a firm are compensated affects risk-taking in the firm. Do you have any sense of that in layman?
I think the Lehman pay system was a pay-for-performance system. I do think the way that the structure of the compensation at Lehman, which was that the senior people, or the people who got paid the most money, got a big chunk of it in Lehman stock that was restricted and deferred for some number of years, I think was a good thing. I do think that folks are, who are in the business are interested in, trying to maximize their compensation. And when people say, does that mean they take undue risks in order to maximize the compensation? I don't think that necessarily follows, but they certainly are out to maximize the revenues that they would generate for the firm. Because they get compensated on the basis of that, how much sort of risk adjustment gets taken into consideration in determining somebody's comp is always a subjective measure. So, I do think it's an important point to really be thought through about, how do you do that? And I think some of the things that have been put in place since and are being hammered out now in the industry are good things to put in play.
As a matter of process, I take it from what you're saying, the risk function would not participate in helping to shape the compensation system, or do I get that wrong?
No, that was correct. That certainly at the time at Lehman, the Lehman's risk management function was not involved in the compensation structure or picture.
Okay. One other set of questions, if I might. We've talked to a lot of people who say, well, nobody could see this unprecedented drop in housing prices. And then other people say, well, we did include scenarios for an unprecedented drop in housing prices in what they call Monte Carlo simulations. Did you use Monte Carlo simulations or otherwise build projections about possible house price changes into any models?
I think folks used all different kinds of sort of methods of quantifying various risks and the outlying risks. So certainly there were various types of things. I'm not familiar with all of them, but certainly there were stress events that were that current positions were run through. The thing I think is any one of these tests in a vacuum, can produce a certain result, but the real challenge is to try to understand how all the positions will behave in aggregate in relation to each other through one of these stress environments. And what we had at Lehman was a whole series of different scenarios that ran the current portfolio of positions through the various sort of scenarios, actual scenarios that had happened in the past, that difficult scenarios that had played out in the past, and try to understand what kind of impact that would have on the current position. There were also ones that were simulated scenarios, situations that actually hadn't happened, but they were imaginable, that our team had put together and tried to sort of look at how bad could it be if certain things happen. It was certainly, it's always a challenging thing to do, particularly if you're trying to sort of model out what would happen to positions that didn't exist the last time that the market ran through a crisis.
Yep.
So it required a fair amount of thought. But our folks were doing that and sort of evolving the thinking around the various kinds of stress and what the impact would be on the firm. I think through all of them, the firm had a sufficient equity cushion to absorb those losses.
I do have one last question. People have told us who worked for investment banks that they felt increasing pressure over the years 2000s, that commercial banks, because they used a different accounting method than mark-to-market, had somehow a competitive advantage. Do you have a sense of that issue?
I certainly have a sense of the issue. It was there was some talk about it. I was aware that there was a different model that was at play, and certainly on the loan side of commercial banks, and there was some, you periodically hear some noise from the businesses, but I never really thought of it as a gigantic to-do.
Okay. I always say, this is the third time I've said last question. We talked about the Turnberry retreat in 2006. Were there other meetings that you can recall where this issue of the new strategy were discussed?
There were a number of situations, whether they be in aggregate or like specific businesses, like getting into India or Russia, or these developing out the business or developing the principal business, principal investing business. So I can't recall the specifically, but I know that there were a number of them.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about when you were, when you were global head of risk management in 07 and into 08. What did, I was wondering if you had a sense in that position that business was changing, especially leading up to the Bear Stearns near collapse and them getting bought up. What was Lehman's, what were you seeing at Lehman during that time frame? Was it getting more difficult to transact business? Was the risk parameters getting more and more difficult because of the situation with Bear? Or were things just moving along as they normally did?
I do think the Bear collapse was in sort of an important moment. Leading up to that, there were you know, there were some rumors and challenges. I think credit spreads were widening a bit. At some point there were, I think maybe after that, but in the near term after that, there were, challenges from the prime brokerage clients about, wanting to have their money. Some of them wanted to have their money, their initial margin deposits, put into separate accounts, for example. A couple of situations like that. So there were some things that were changing, but it wasn't. I wouldn't consider it a fundamental rethink. I think folks just looked and said Bear Stearns was a little bit different, had set itself up differently. And I know that our finance function at the time did some, spent time trying to understand the differences in how, Bear had been set up liquidity-wise versus how we had been set up. And, I wasn't on point on that. So, the finance folks would be best to speak with about that. But I do think that, post the Bear situation, there was just more, I'll just call it, stress in the system.
And I guess as we move forward after March of 2008 and we move towards September of 2008, I guess it was your sense the business climate was getting more and more difficult for Lehman to operate. Because of the Bear situation, or did people think that Lehman was not going to fail, that Lehman was going to be, rescued somehow from another suitor or by the government? I mean, what was your take on that during that time frame?
Yeah, I don't think it was anything about getting rescued by the government or another suitor. I just think that people looked at Bear and said it was in a fundamentally different condition. It didn't have as big and broad a business system that Lehman did. It set itself up differently liquidity-wise, or at least that was the thought. And that, Lehman was going to, just move forward and have an opportunity to pick up some additional business. But I think what Lehman ran into some challenges as a result of, some of what happened in the market in terms of pressured selling of certain less liquid assets coming out in the market had forced prices down. That translated through, and Lehman had to mark some of its positions down. That led to some losses. Those losses weren't taken well by investors. That led to a confidence problem, and I think it just sort of kind of went from there, although it didn't, it wasn't, you sort of look back now and have a different feeling about it, but at the time it was just viewed as Lehman ran through a difficult period, in the second quarter, suffered losses. That's kind of a one-time thing just because of this pressured selling that put pressure on, the asset prices, and that, Lehman was going to be fine. And, I think that was the view, and when the losses materialized in the third quarter as well, I think that became something that folks said that, the market has now lost confidence. Less about does Lehman have lost confidence in Lehman for having lost so much money, and then there began to be questions about the kinds of things. Maybe there were some questions along the way about the values of less liquid assets and what kinds of less liquid assets are on the books, and how bad could those losses be if the market really collapsed. And even though I was confident that Lehman had a sufficient liquidity equity cushion to support the losses that could be suffered from the positions, the market I think was had lost confidence and basically created a run on the place.
Can we talk about that in more detail, particularly the early phases where, as you say, Lehman had to sell things and I guess one would say fire sale prices? Why didn't the liquidity policy hold at that point and prevent that beginning from having sort of that unraveling from taking place?
Yeah, I don't think I didn't mean to suggest that Lehman had to sell because of liquidity. I was saying that there were some forced sellers in the market. So some of the participants in the market, maybe some hedge funds, for example, had to sell. They were being forced to delever, and they then had to sell out their assets into the market, which forced prices down.
So you had to market your price.
Yeah, those repricings pushed values down, which created some losses.
Got it.
And it, you know, sort of that. So I don't think for Lehman, I don't think it was a liquidity issue where Lehman had to sell assets to generate liquidity at that time.
Thank you.
So when you were CFO, was there any kind of, was the top management saying that we need to decrease our leverage, or did that happen after you had transitioned into your role as the into the risk management side?
It was after, you know, there was a sort of a conscious decision at some point in 08 to, you know, effect a sort of de-risking and, you know, sort of selling of assets strategy.
Mr. O'Meara, during the third quarter of 08, did you get any signals from the government that they would do anything to help finance your company?
I didn't. But I'm not sure I would have been the person to get those signals if those signals were to be given.
What about, do you remember hearing anything in the public, in the newspapers or in the press at that time, about the government possibly doing the same thing they did with Bear Stearns?
I remember there being some something where it said the opposite of that, is that that the government would not step in and do that.
Okay. And finally, what we've heard from the Fed is that, are you familiar with their regulation 13.3?
I'm not sure. I don't know what it is.
Well, 13.3 allows them to fund companies that have systemic issues, systemic risk issues. And so what we've heard from them is that when they assessed your collateral, they were unwilling to lend you money. Do you know anything about that, that credit assessment that they did, that the Fed undertook?
I
mean, do you know if they contacted
don't.
You? Okay. Okay, thank you.
A couple other questions. In 2007, when you were the CFO and then you transitioned into the risk management role, was that a transition that you wanted to happen, or were you told that you were changing roles?
I was told that I was changing roles. Well, it wasn't quite that way. If you give me those two choices, it would be that one, but it wasn't quite that way.
Kind of explain to us what happened.
Joe Gregory had come to me and asked me if I would be open to the idea of doing something different, and he had a thought of, he wanted somebody else to potentially come into the CFO role. I told him that I was on the team, and, you know, whatever the guys wanted me to consider, I certainly would consider. I would also say at the time that, Joe had expressed concern just about me and my personal well-being, just because it's being a CFO is sort of an all-consuming job, and, you know, it's sort of hard to get a good work-life balance. You know what I mean? It's just a lot of hours that were required in the role, and he had, you know, sort of been concerned over time about, you know, helping me with the work life balance. But I don't, you know, I think he had in his mind that he wanted to make a change and ask me if I'd be open to doing something different, and I told him I would.
So was the risk management position more accommodating of a work-life balance?
No, it wasn't. It was certainly a sort of relatively smaller organization to manage, but it was, it was a full agenda.
And when you took over that role from, you said, from Madeline, was she ready to transition to another position, or did they approach her and ask her to move out of that role to make a space for you, or what was that situation?
Well, the way I understood it was that she had indicated that she wanted to do something different, and so that role was going to become available, and they were considering me for it.
Okay.
What do you think precipitated the next leadership change in June with Callan stepping down and Gregory stepping down?
Well, I do think that, and there's been, sort of a lot in the press about and in the books about it. I just think that this confidence, the market confidence and, the sort of the workforce, there's a lot of people who have a view, who are in touch with clients, and I think the thought was that there needed to be a change at the firm, and Joe and Aaron recognized that and agreed to move on.
Did Ms. Callan do anything different with that role as CFO?
She, everybody sort of operates with their own style in their roles. I think she was more sort of public communicator than I was in the role.
Mm-hmm.
More frequent communicator and a public persona.
Yeah, I want to go back to this stress testing. Can you just describe the process from 04 through 07, end of 07? Who was on it? How it was done? What considerations went into it?
Well, I wasn't really I wasn't in the risk seat at that time, so I don't think that I'd be a good person to comment on what was happening at that time. But I know that the guys had developed a whole series of different stress tests.
Mm-hmm.
I would periodically see them and hear about them from my CFO seat. I always thought they were thoughtful. They were deep. They captured a lot of they weren't something where somebody sort of took a high-level swag at it. These were deep, systematic, quantitative scenarios that current positions were run through. And, they would result in losses in many cases. And, they were all different scenarios. Some would result in big gains, depending on mm-hmm. how you were positioned. But, but the losses could be significant. But, certainly, easily absorbed by the equity cushion in the firm.
The examiner is critical that the growth in private equity and leveraged loans weren't included in those stress testing until the very end. Do you know why that was?
I don't. I can tell you, one of the things that had come up, because they wound up getting included at the very end when I came in the seat, sort of understood a little bit more about it. But I think one of the things that was at play was the stress tests, or the scenarios, the historical scenarios that were run through, were sort of 4 to 6 week episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And the, like a big real estate decline would be historically anyway, a 2 to 4 year sort of relatively gradual decline in values that could be watched over time, not sort of in the course of a half a quarter, because there just wasn't, good day-to-day price transparency historically about, commercial real estate properties. and so, you know, the thought was that we should just be subject to a different set of stress tests rather than be included in the scenario that, you know, covered the episodes that happened for stress in the past. So it wasn't that they were being ignored. They just weren't included in those scenario tests. There were just different different ways of capturing those stresses.
Can you describe the SEC regulation through the CSE process? Are you familiar with that?
Yes. So the SEC was very much involved and had a team of people who were on the Lehman account. They would come on site once a month and were religious about it.
Do you remember the names of the SEC regulators?
I can tell you some of the names.
Okay.
Matt Eichner was a senior operator. Lori Bettinger was a woman on our account who was, I think, reported up into Matt.
Mm-hmm.
God, I'm drawing a blank here. There were early on in the case, but then Bob Cleland was on it, and then at some point he retired. But there were, you know, there were a couple of other operators who I know, who I just, their names just aren't coming to my head right now.
And who did they meet with at Lehman?
They would meet with some folks from my department, and periodically I would go, but not all the time, depending on the subject, or if they wanted to talk to me, I would go. But the people from the risk department would be Paul Schotten, who was head of our risk control and analysis, Jeff Goodman, who was head of our fixed income market risk. Those guys would go. Others would go, Vince DiMassimo, who was head of our credit risk management function, and then we would bring other people in as they were needed, if their subjects were touched on. So there would be some contingent of folks from risk, who are the people I just said. There would also be a contingent of folks from the finance department, which would include Martin Kelly, who was the financial controller, Tony Stucchio, who was the head of regulatory reporting in the finance department, and certain other people. There, you know, there would be a room full of people around the table. Laura Vecchio was another name who was part of that, who was helping to manage the relationship with the SEC. But it wasn't just these monthly discussions. There were those. There were the formal updates once a month, but in addition to that, there was, you know, it seemed to be ongoing dialogue around phone calls and, you know, questions that would pop up that folks would be in dialogue on. So it was, you know, it was, you know, part of, they were sort of interwoven into the, you know, the goings on at the firm, and, you know, the idea was to, you know, talk to them about the things that are happening, get them essentially, you know, have them inside the tent, and, you know, I think they knew everything we knew.
So throughout 06 and 07, did the SEC know about your growth in private equity, leveraged loans, and commercial real estate?
I can't answer that specifically, but yeah, they made sure they were on the reports and people would have been talking about them, so I imagine so.
And were those factors included in the stress test at that time?
They were in the, you know, in the regulatory capital calculations, had a way of handling all these different categories of assets at risk. And so, yeah, they were included in there. And, you know, in whatever way was appropriate under the CSE models to include them.
Can you just describe the CSE model for Lehman Brothers for us?
I may not be the best person to describe that, but, you know, there was, it's sort of a, in detail, but there, it's, you know, it's a Basel-like calculation that does use VAR stepped up for a higher confidence level and, you know, sort of a multiplier, greater number of days, and has a whole series of basically add-ons for less liquid assets. And, you know, that creates the, you know, the risk-weighted assets. And against that, that is sort of compared up against the equity capital of the firm as defined. And, you know, the equity capital was the firm's equity, certain qualifying other capital instruments, less, less, I think it was goodwill, certain deferred tax assets, and certain other, well, I'll just call them intangible assets, were deducted directly from equity. And the ratio, you know, needed to be north of 10%, the capital ratio. And ours was, and actually, you know, as 08 ticked on, it actually became more, you know, it significantly over 10% over time. So we were, you know, sort of in compliance in the well-capitalized space under that calculation.
Just a point of clarification, please. Were they concerned about the leverage of the investment bank or of the holding company? The parent or the...
It was the whole... It was the parent, the consolidated company.
Okay. Yes.
When you say, were they concerned about the leverage, meaning that test was done. There were two tests done. One was at the holding company, the aggregate, and then there was a different test that was done for the broker-dealer.
Okay.
And how many tests were done in 2007?
When you say tests, when I said the term test before, it was monthly that it would be reported on. You know, that's what I got was okay. The monthly updates.
And Lehman passed each one every time. Is that right?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Now, in 2008, I understand that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the SEC were on site every day after Bear Stearns collapsed.
Okay.
And apparently, Lehman failed both the Bear Stearns and the Bear Stearns Light stress test. Do you know anything about that, or?
No, well, I had heard something about that afterwards. Okay. Which was news at the time that I think I read it in a book somewhere, but I was not aware of that. The folks who were on site were not on site and on my floor, so you know, I wasn't seeing them day to day. But I know that folks were on site with our Treasury Department for at least some period of time, which was on a different floor in a different building.
When you talked to the SEC people, did it appear to you that they understood what they needed to do and that they were doing it in a capable way?
Yeah, I felt that at the time, certainly.
Were they only trying to administer the Basel formula, or were they also looking at safety and soundness more generically, the way you might have looked at it as a risk officer?
Oh, you know, I think that there was lots of dialogue about, you know, things that were going on in the market, and, you know, they were trying to stay as informed about what was happening in the world and how it impacted our firm and the other firms as they could. So, you know, I don't know how to answer the specific question about the safety and soundness thing. That sort of, but they, you know, certainly were interested in what was happening and, you know, tried to stay abreast of all of the goings on in the marketplace that they could.
How many people did they have involved?
Not so many, but I could think of, you know, a half a dozen who would traffic around there. There'd be some specific subjects that they might bring, you know, a particular expert in on. But it wasn't a giant team of people.
You want to ask something? Follow-up?
Yeah, and I want to go back to 2007. The examiner's critical about the growth of the leveraged loan business, private equity, and commercial real estate during that time frame. Do you express any concerns about the rapid growth of any of those businesses in 2007?
Yeah, particularly around the leveraged loan business. That mm-hmm. was the one that was the subject of a lot of dialogue. You know, this mm-hmm. was in support of investment banking business, and these were, you know, there was a flurry of activity in the leveraged buyout market, and, you know, there was, situations where we would either be advising these companies around, these leveraged buyout companies around acquiring, the target properties, and we would help to provide a financing package to them, some of which they would use, some of which they wouldn't use, some deals that they would bid on but not win. So there was a fair amount of uncertainty about whether the company you were backing was actually even going to win the target. So there was, you know, what we call these contingent commitments that were made. So, you know, we were making commitments, recognizing that there was a possibility, and frequently a good possibility, that the acquirer who we were backing wouldn't even win the property.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an uncertainty that was in play at the time. But mm-hmm. There were, but there were a lot of these commitments that that the firm made, and some of them were, you know, ones that you could get out of them if there was a material adverse change either in the company or in the market, and some of them you couldn't. But, you know, as time went on and some of these began to close or need funding, the ones that did win and we did back, and then the market that into which these items would typically be distributed was challenging. We wound up holding some portion of these and, you know, sort of working them out over the coming months, meaning over the months that ended 07 and began 08. And so, you know, I think we were successful in doing that.
Did you express your concerns to Fold and Gregory early 2007?
I think so, just in the context of, you know, everybody knew. I think it was my role, among others, Madeline's mm-hmm. role too, to make sure that as folks were talking about these various commitments, that, you know, that we had to keep them abreast, that we had a lot of them on to talk to people about what was already on and what could potentially happen in terms of the funding.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was that information was on the table, but it wasn't something that we were sort of so alarmed about that we wanted to, you know, say let's not do these, but we, you know, certainly had gotten conscious of them and at some point had dialed them back because we viewed that, you know, sort of the cup was full, kind of thing.
Now, in May 2007, Gelband was replaced by Nagyoff as the head of fixed income. Do you remember that?
Yep.
And Alex Kirk seems to think that he was transitioned out because of Gelband's opposition to the growth in loan leverage. Do you have any views on that?
I don't know that it was specific. I'm not that. I wasn't part of those discussions, but meaning discussions about him transitioning out and making a decision to leave. So I don't have firsthand knowledge, but there was. Mike was on the executive committee and, you know, was part of the, the team that would discuss these various situations and, the executive committee would make a decision as a group, including the input from all the members.
If may I generalize from that experience and ask a question, whether it was dangerous for somebody's career path to object to the new strategy of increasing the growth of the firm?
I don't think it was dangerous. I think people had an opportunity and actually did put their views on the table. Just wouldn't always go their way, right? You know, people might have an opposition to a particular deal or want a particular deal that winds up getting, shot down. But the thing that they should feel comfortable with is that there was the dialogue, that debate was held in around a table that, was evidence of a good process from my perspective, that the most senior members of the firm were engaged in the dialogue to make the decision around the most important risk items for the firm.
Did Dick Fuld and Joe Gregory know about your concerns about the growth in real estate in early 2008, 2007?
Yeah, if you say my concern, I certainly had, some concern that we were building this up and, is this moving out of here fast enough, and sort of what part of the capital structure are we investing in when we, make these loans. I'm sure that they were aware that, we had these items and, they were items that represented risk. And, in terms of my, quote, concern, I had lots of things I would express concern about. That was one of them. And, they would take that on board and consider it in making the decisions for the firm.
Just to clarify regarding your concern, I'm referring to a May 2007 email from Goodman to Antonchik saying that you had concerns about the size of the real estate book and how it's tied up to the bridge equity deals. So is that accurate around that time frame?
Oh, God, we're reaching back. But, if Jeff was saying something in an email to... I must have had a conversation with him. It's probably, that might have been right around you said May 07?
Yep.
That might have been right around the time of doing the Archstone deal and saying, this is a big deal. Mm-hmm. This is going to eat up, a fair amount of capacity that we have, and, we have some other things on that are in this space. And but to say there's concern is different than to say, I'm sort of freaked out about it. It's just, a notable concern.
But Fuld and Gregory would know about your concern. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Regarding the risk limits, it looks like it was increased throughout 2007. Is that correct?
I think it was increased every year.
Okay. And?
But there was a more pronounced increase in 07.
I think that's it. One other question. Hang on.
When you switched to CSE, or when the SEC switched to CSE, that was something brand new for them in terms of something really they'd never regulated before and were never really set up to regulate before. They were looking at different types of risk. Did you get the impression that they were up to speed? And they had enough resources to provide that sort of oversight?
Yeah, the resource one is an interesting question when it comes down, certainly looking back, you look at the challenge and, you sort of look at the relatively thin staff, but certainly the people were... did all the work necessary to get up to speed. They spent the time. They had some risk professionals that they had brought on And but it was, there's no question looking back, it was a very, very big challenge for not so big group of people.
Well, I mean before that, they basically, their oversight function was to make sure regulated broker dealers stayed solvent. And you guys and everybody in your business would have helped them out with that, in that you ran your regulated broker dealers, so you were within their net capital rules. And that, I mean, that's basically the only thing the SEC was looking at before that, isn't it?
Well, they were looking at some other things, but that was the primary thing. I agree with you.
Yeah, and then to go to looking at the overall conglomerate, the consolidated holding company, if you will, for Basel purposes, was really quite something quite different.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, okay. And and in doing so, were they more or less applying the rules of Basel mechanically? Were they? I guess it doesn't take much to get up to speed mechanically in terms of applying Basel, but that isn't necessarily going to determine whether or not a financial institution is going to meet its obligations as they become due. It's just, am I wrong? You indicated before, you said that you were well capitalized.
Yeah.
Right up until the end.
Right.
So Basel doesn't cover everything, apparently.
Well, I don't know about the Lehman demise as being a capital issue as much as a liquidity issue.
That's my point. Thank you. Yeah. And they probably weren't necessarily looking for that. Looking at it on a liquidity.
Well, they had a team, and one of their elements was to be very close to and in touch with the sort of the liquidity models and liquidity projections, et cetera. So they were that was one of the things that was in the items that they were looking at closely.
But it didn't kick out any comment or anything like that. I mean, there was obviously people at Lehman Brothers, yourself included, I suspect, who saw the liquidity problem coming.
No, certainly not myself included, but I don't know about others, but I don't think so. I think that there were some unforeseen things that took place in the very late stages about liquidity grabs made by certain players in the market, including those who were our clearing banks, that that I think were unanticipated. But there were others who were better suited to talk about that.
Who would they be?
Folks outside of the risk department. The risk department was responsible for market risk and credit risk and operational risk. Liquidity risk was not something that the risk department was responsible for. That was the Treasury Department under the CFO.
Can you talk a little bit about ALCO, the Asset Liability Committee, and why that was created?
In 07, there were a couple of things that happened in the market with regard to I don't know what they call the the structured investment vehicle commercial paper fundings, these remarketing fundings, commercial paper that ran into some challenges, and the business that was handling this for our clients in our fixed income division was had some concerns about what that meant in the market, and that it was different, and it was a different kind of challenge in the in terms of liquidity in the markets for our clients. And we decided to pull the group together, the group of the secured funding team, our treasury team, which is the unsecured funding team, and the certain of the business folks, so that we could all huddle and understand whether, you know, sort of what was happening in these markets day to day, because they were not functioning as they historically had. And it was a prudent thing to do to get people together to try to understand how that would impact our business and our clients and ourselves. And so that meeting was set up to have that dialogue on a day-to-day basis for some period of time.
And what did you find? What did that committee find?
Well, I think it was just really to stay in touch. These kinds of things are, you know, you set up just to make sure that you have real-time dialogue and get all the people who might be affected or might want to know about what was happening in the markets to get them all on a call and have dialogue. I don't think it was really in the hunt for any particular bit of information, but it was an opportunity and a forum for us to all come together and share information real-time.
And was that committee in existence until September 08, or when did it end?
I don't know when it ended. I think the ALCO concept was always there. You always knew who the people were who you were going to hook up if you wanted to pull together the ALCO group, but I don't think that it continued. I think that was just for some period of time while I went through that stress event, and then I think it, I don't remember it continuing, and if it did, I wasn't participating after I shifted out of the CFO seat.
And did you lead that committee?
I don't know when you call it a committee. I still had some dialogue with certainly with some of those people, but not not necessarily on that subject of liquidity.
If I can ask a question, and this is remedial education. You indicated that you were relatively comfortable with the liquidity policy, and yet at some point there was a run on Lehman that Lehman couldn't stop. How would you characterize that risk? What was that risk if it wasn't liquidity risk?
Yeah, no, I think it is liquidity risk. I think I was just not being in the risk seat. I was away from the center of what was going on the liquidity side at the end, meaning in the last several months, or certainly ever since I moved into the risk spot. But the way I understand it now, just looking at looking backwards at some of what happened, this grabbing of collateral by clearing banks was not something that was forecast in a liquidity model. The liquidity model had specific things that it would forecast out as being sort of negative cash events that would take place in a stress environment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were a lot of them. A lot of different theories were taken into consideration and, you know, amounts set aside to support them. But, the way I understand the amount of collateral that was grabbed by various clearing banks is just an enormous amount of cash that was sucked out of the system.
Who was your main clearing bank? Was it J.P. Morgan? Was that the one you used the most?
Yes.
And
for repo financing and others for different businesses, like, you know, FX clearing was somebody different, and but there were a number of banks that basically grabbed collateral cash from the firm.
And what were these calls? What were the collateral calls in regards to? Was it repo? Was it other? I mean, what were they?
Some was just to make those clearing banks have a comfort deposit about, you know, intraday risk or what they perceived to be intraday risk. And I was not on point for that. I'm just looking back and seeing what, you know, I sort of read about and hear about.
Was Lehman making calls on its counterparties at the same time?
Yes, for situations where we had exposure to counterparties, we would make those calls.
So that was the practice in the industry, that as market values dropped and you guys were on a mark-to-market basis, the various players would call on each other in order to settle up. Is that a fair statement?
That's correct.
So what was different this time that couldn't be worked into a liquidity model?
Well, I don't think things were different. You might say that there, through these difficult times, there winds up being some, what are billed as operational hiccups, where, you might call for collateral, it might not come in the same day. People are a little bit more reluctant to send in money, but they ultimately get it in through the stress. But this thing with the clearing banks soaking out liquidity was, that's what's different, is that that hadn't never happened before.
Normally, even in tough times, the clearing bank, in order to preserve the opportunity of future business, would offer some protection here. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying it's not, I'm saying the question ultimately is going to be is, were they actually at risk, or did they sort of grab liquidity that was in excess of what their risk was, right? Because there's always, they're sort of operating as a clearing bank, but there's, a question just how much risk, if any, are they running, and, are they entitled to, sort of soak out liquidity just because they deem that maybe they're at risk? Or is that something that should be agreed upon, that there really is risk? But it seems like in the case of a stressed environment, the firm that's undergoing the stress becomes less involved in the dialogue about whether or not there's risk for the other guy.
I assume that this was a simple call based on change of mark-to-market values rather than an assessment of risk. Is that wrong?
No, that's not right in this case.
What was the legal basis of a call, then, to understand this?
Unfortunately, I'm not the person who's on point for this, so I'm just telling you what I'm sort of reading about and hearing about looking backwards. But I think the folks who are in the Treasury area or the CFO area would be best to talk about what happened at the end.
Okay.
So would that be Ian Lowitt and Tanucci, or who would you recommend that we talk to?
Probably. Or if they're not right, they could be better to tell you who is right.
Okay.
So did that help precipitate Lehman's failure? I know you've alluded to this bits and pieces, but can you just summarize why Lehman failed? Just your own opinion.
Yeah, I think having two losses, two large losses in two quarters in a row, and having all of what this confluence of events about how the market had lost confidence in the rating agency's assessment of certain products, so the market had lost its own sort of ability to feel comfortable with the values and the quality of assets inside of the financial firms. Then for Lehman to have had these two major losses in two quarters in a row, really sort of got. And then this thing with the confidence in the values of these securities, or what even the securities are. These any structured security, even if it was rated AAA, that historically would be repoable in a market, became, nobody wanted to support those, and I just think it just became, just a confidence issue where the market, and when I say the market, meaning all of the stakeholders who interacted with the firm, you know, and there was lots of other things that were going on at the same time, in terms of, you know, there's lots of things about, you know, rumors in the market that we were talking to somebody about having a combination or a merger, and then that fell through, and, you know, credit spreads widening, you know, lots of discussion about naked short selling, you know, all these things that were, whether they were real or not, they were perceived, and, you know, so it's really just, it's hard to put your finger on a particular thing, but I think it's this confluence of events that created a confidence issue, and you know, ultimately, the government was unwilling to step in and try to provide support to keep it from hitting the wall.
Okay. Well, we really want to thank you for your time today. Appreciate all the responses. It's helped us greatly. And that's about it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, John.
Take care.
All right.
Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.